Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I've been told I should ask you again to switch off your phones. It's lovely to have Paul Krugman here with us again, not for the first time by any manner of means. As you know, Paul is the world's most famous economist since Milton Friedman, with the difference that he's more often right. He currently has his chair at Princeton, and he's also a visiting professor in the Center for Economic Performance here, where he regularly comes in the summer and has written a very important book with Tony Venables on economic geography. At Princeton, his subject is meant to be international trade, but he manages to do the same amount of journalism as some people I see present. He writes two columns a week in the New York Times. He's writing an introductory economics textbook, etc. I think some of the columns must have been about the subject of today's lecture, namely the US budget. And I believe that Paul also wrote a book on that subject in I'm not sure how many days. But he now has an hour and a bit to tell us about the subject. Paul.
Well, thanks. I am going to talk about a very American topic, something that's on my mind a lot in my role as columnist. I think it's actually also intellectually interesting, and it's certainly important. What we're watching is something truly remarkable. The change in the U.S. fiscal position in the last 2 years has, well, I guess you could call it a sort of miracle if you can have negative miracles. And it's, I won't be too coy. You probably saw the announcement that I gave for the poster. Basically, it's a story, on the face of it, the numbers look really quite bad. On closer examination, it's much, much worse. The actual story here is, well, let me tell you, the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to, roughly speaking, do a Dance of the Seven Veils here. I'm going to pull back successive layers to explain what's going on. So there's first the mechanics, and then what went behind that, what went behind that, and so on, back to the political economy of the whole thing. My bottom line is it's pretty scary. We are doing a pretty impressive imitation, at least, of a descent into banana republicness in the United States. But let me go through the story about what's happening. I'll end with a mystery. There's some things I don't quite understand about what's going on, but there's a lot of things that we can understand. Just the first thing, the numbers in fiscal, I don't know how UK fiscal years run. The United States has this odd thing still that budgets are September to August. So we start the year after the people come in from taking in the crops still, even though nobody does that anymore. Nobody does it, but they're getting $190 billion to subsidy anyway. We went from our peak was a fiscal in fiscal 2000, which is September 99 to August 2000, was almost $240 billion, and in fiscal 2002, which isn't over yet, but we have a pretty good idea of what it's going to look like. We seem to be looking at something like a deficit of $160 billion. So in these 2 years, we've had a swing of $400 billion. A convenient fact about the United States right now is that GDP is about $10 trillion, so $100 billion is 1%. So roughly a 4% of GDP swing in 2 years. The long-term budget estimates, which are garbage, as I'll explain in a little while, but for what it's worth, the long-term budget forecast, the 10-year forecast, went from a surplus of $5.6 trillion that was estimated a year ago. Latest forecasts are suggesting something like $1 trillion. So we lost, somehow along the way, we lost $4.5 trillion. And again, that's probably an underestimate. So it's a pretty spectacular deterioration in the fiscal prospect. What I'm going to do is explain mechanically, so far as we can, how that happened, why we pursued the policies that contributed to that, the political economy behind those, and then a little bit about the consequences. All right. There's a game that's played in Washington a lot, which is, in a way, a little bit silly, which is apportioning the blame for this deterioration. What percentage of the deterioration is due to the Bush tax cut? What percentage due to the recession, and so on? I think the reason there's a natural human tendency to want to say, how can we place the blame? There's also doing it that way offers tremendous opportunities for spin, because you can play with time frames and so on. So if you ask, if somebody can say the tax cut is only a minor factor in the budget deterioration, and not exactly be lying because he's only talking about the current fiscal year when most of the tax cut hasn't happened yet, and can verify evade talking about the long-term consequences and so on. But still, for what it's worth, the current fiscal year stuff looks like the following. The tax cut is indeed a relatively minor factor. It's something like $60 billion, all told, of revenue losses because of the tax cut. The reason it's so small is that the tax cut that was passed last year is heavily backloaded. It starts with little things. Actually, what it does, it starts with tax cuts for the middle class, which are relatively small. So the most people in the United States are either pay no income tax or are in the were in the 15% bracket, and they're now paying 10% on their taxable income. And that's a relatively small number. The big money comes later on. The big money comes as the higher rates fall. So roughly speaking, only about 40% of the fully phased-in tax cut has actually occurred. The other 60% is still to come. Nearly all of what's still to come is very tilted towards the high end. According to the latest estimates I've seen, by the time the thing is fully phased in, which is in 2010, more than half of it will go to just the top 1% of the population. And that's now something funny happens in 2011, but I'll get to that. Okay, so far the tax cut is not that big a deal. What about the war on terror and all of that? Also not even a smaller deal. We have big military spending increases, but they're in the pipeline. Not much has happened yet. The war in Afghanistan was cheap by the standards of these things, about $1 billion a month, which is rounding error for the US budget. It's a big country and it's a big, big budget. The homeland security and so on is also not much has it probably. You can play with these numbers, but probably all of that is 30 or 40 billion. So it must be the recession, right? And what's funny about it is it turns out that while the recession is a much bigger deal than either of those, it's not nearly enough to explain the downturn in revenues. If you take the recession, it's probably, it's not much of a recession, at least not so far by historical standards. Unemployment rate went from 4%, which was extremely low, to about 6% now. That is something like $100 billion of revenue loss associated with that much downturn. If you add up the numbers I've been putting, you'll notice there's a really big gap there. They don't seem to add up to the total. The answer appears to be, in large part, the end of the stock market bubble. That we had a lot of, it's not so much cyclical as the fact that stock prices were very high and rising, so people were getting a lot of capital gains. That's probably not enough. And there's another mystery factor, I believe, in the numbers. And since all of this is very preliminary, we can't be quite sure. But there's some reason to believe that we're actually just having a decline in reporting of actual income. And I'll come back to that, because it's one of the ominous things that I really worry about for the U.S. future. The usual implication that people want to take from this kind of calculation is that it's since the tax cut is not the predominant force in the current decline of the budget, that we don't need to worry if the tax cut was not a bad idea, because it's not the big villain. The right way to read this kind of number is to say, guys, it's not going to fix itself. The recession is only 100, maybe a bit more billion of revenue loss. So even if we have a full recovery back to 4% unemployment, which seems, aside from the fact that there's no sign of that happening at the moment, seems rather low. But even so, that only gets rid of part of this drastic deterioration in the budget. Since the tax cut is phased in, so it gets larger over the years, and since the big military spending increases post September 11th are phased in over the pipeline, basically it doesn't get any better, or at least not much better. There's no reason at all to think that we're going to be headed for a balanced budget, basically ever. There's nothing in there to suggest that we've moved from limitless surpluses in the prospect, so we thought, to permanent deficits in 2 years, and you know, so that's the real story. There's no reason at all to think that we have a turnaround. I'm not even sure that we'll see the deficit decline as a share of GDP. We're not seeing much turnaround there at all. If you were to say to yourself, think back to what we had a debate last year over during the election, and then again last year over tax cuts, and the assertion was that there was a large enough that we could afford a large tax cut, which will at by the time it's fully phased in be around 1.7% of GDP, and that we could do that while at the same time making provision for the future. I guess I'll have to talk about the Social Security surplus in a minute. That was easily affordable. Now we have a situation where we have persistent deficits of 1.something% of GDP, as far as the eye can see. And you have to say, what were we doing with that tax cut? Counterfactual, if we hadn't passed the tax cut, we would still be in deficit this year, obviously. And we would still be in deficit next year and the year after that. We might have the prospect of returning to a budget surplus a few years out from now. We might, it would certainly be inadequate given the known needs for paying for retirement in the next decade, and I'll come to that in a minute. But at least it would be a little bit milder. So the question is, how did we do that? You might say, well, it was because we had no reason to expect anything like this. That there was, we had a long stretch of big surpluses and had every reason to believe they would continue. And that's where the story starts to get a little bit funny. And I was actually myself, I've been working on this, reporting on it all the time. I was a little startled to look back at the numbers. The US reports its budget numbers as on budget and off budget. I don't know, again, everybody does something like this, but we have basically that's Social Security. And Social Security is a system of retirement in which people pay hypothecated. I learned that from reading the British press. We don't actually have to worry about it. It's a hypothecated tax, the payroll tax, which is used only to pay for, supposedly used only to pay for benefits. Historically, it's been run as a pay-as-you-go system. So each generation pays for the previous generation's retirement. Since the 1980s, it has run a significant, though not all that large, surplus, acquiring a trust fund in anticipation of my generation hitting retirement age. But basically, it's still a pay-as-you-go system with a surplus. And when you look at the on-budget numbers, it's the surplus outside Social Security. Any reasonable estimate says that the U.S. government, if it's trying to maintain a sort of Ricardian ideal of unchanged tax rates over time, ought to be running a surplus now that is larger than the surplus run by the Social Security system. The way you can tell that is that the system itself is not quite solvent under standard estimates. So we actually need to be running up more than that in order to not have to raise taxes when the baby boomers retire. So how have we been doing on surpluses outside the Social Security system? The answer is that we began running surpluses outside the Social Security system in fiscal 99. Until then, it was consistently deficits. In fiscal 99, we ran a surplus which was $1.8 billion over the year. That's zero by, you know, again, for the U.S., that's rounding error. So we ran a fiscal surplus outside of Social Security, significant one in 2000, fiscal 2000. And then that was the last one. So we launched into this very large tax cut, in the end, as I say, about 1.7% of GDP, based on exactly 1 year of significant surpluses outside Social Security. There was not a sustained period when we could have said, well, surpluses are our normal condition. We need to do something about that. We had exactly 1 year. How on earth did that become the basis for very large tax cuts? Well, a lot of it was that people looked not at the actual, they looked not at the past, but at the future. And in particular, at the projected future. And the Congressional Budget Office does projections, supposedly nonpartisan, and I think I would say actually nonpartisan, projections of 10-year budgets surpluses, which came, the debate over what to do with the 10-year budget surplus became a the center of the policy debate. Now, first thing to say about that is that a 10-year projection, I think, is the pessimal time frame. You can't do worse than that. It's too long to have any idea what it's really going to look like. The range of uncertainty over 10 years, as we've just seen, is enormous. Nobody has the faintest idea what the world will look like in 10 years. On the other hand, it's too short to take into account the long-run demographic issues. And in particular, for a tax debate that was taking place in 2001, it was precisely it's almost as if, you know, I can almost believe that this was conspiratorial. By using a 10-year horizon, our budget numbers stopped just short of the first year in which the baby boom generation would hit age 65 and thereby become eligible for Social Security and Medicare benefits. So we managed to exclude the known large expenses that are coming, but just over the budgeting horizon. Then within that, there are a number of assumptions that the Congressional Budget Office is obliged to make. I'd meant to check the exact date, but since the sometime in the mid-1990s, since the Republicans took control of Congress, which is not irrelevant, the guidelines for the CBO have required it in its projections to assume that discretionary spending, sorry, all these U.S. budget terms, but discretionary spending, which is not Medicare, not Social Security, not the defined benefits, but the things that are provided by, you know, that Congress decides on each year, that discretionary spending in real terms will be unchanged from the budgeting year. So if it's 2001 and you're making a budget projection for the next 10 years, you assume that there will be no real growth in spending on the military, highways, air traffic control, et cetera, for the next 10 years. Not even no real growth per capita, but no real growth at all. Now, since the economy grows over time, automatically, if you assume zero real growth in spending, revenues will rise. So this automatically projects, if you start from a surplus, it projects rapidly growing surpluses over the next 10 years. If you start from a deficit, provided it's not too big, it projects automatically that you will move into surplus later in the decade. So it created a inherent bias towards overstatement. And they're still doing it. So when I say that 1.something trillion dollar forecast for 10 years is garbage, that's mostly what I mean. That in fact, if you make a more reason, if you assume that discretionary spending is going to be constant as a share of GDP, which is what an economist would probably do, then you get the result that basically we're going to be running deficits as a share of GDP comparable to what we're doing right now throughout the decade, and which gives you a deficit of several trillion over the course of the decade. I think if you want to understand why that, you know, those peculiar assumptions are built into the forecast, the answer is, of course, that It was a mixture between a desire to make the forecasts look larger so as to justify tax cuts and a wishful thought about what should happen to the government, because essentially the controlling majority in Congress not in a position to force through the downsizing of government it wanted, could at least have its wish list built into the forecasts so that you don't do what they say they want, then you find yourself with much bigger budget problems than you bargained on. All right. All of this should have been pretty obvious. In fact, it was. I mean, the collapse in revenue that happened this year was bigger than I think anyone anticipated. But it was pretty obvious to anybody willing to look at it that the numbers being used to justify tax cuts didn't really hang together, and that we were probably a couple of trillion dollars off on that 10-year forecast. So given all that, how come we did the big tax cut? And the answer there is that there was a full court press with some unlikely allies. Probably the decisive moment in the debate came when Alan Greenspan intervened, stepping rather outside his role as head of the central bank, saying that it was urgent to have a tax cut because he was afraid that we would run excessive surpluses and run out of federal debt to pay off, which looks a little funny a year later. What was particularly odd about that was that at the very same time, the administration was, and still is, pushing for its plan to partially privatize the Social Security system, which would create younger workers would be able to put part of their payroll tax into personal accounts rather than just into the common pool. That itself adds another major requirement for funding. Because, again, we have a pay-as-you-go system. Each generation pays for the previous generation's retirement. It's also largely an unfunded system for that reason. If you take a large chunk of the revenues that are currently paying benefits to retired people and put them into personal accounts instead, you've got a hole that's got to be filled somehow. And that in itself, just Social Security reform, if reform is what it is, would have solved Greenspan's problem of excessive surpluses, which of course didn't turn out to be a problem anyway. Last in all of that was that the tax cut itself had made substantially understated costs in terms of revenue. And part of that is technical stuff, which is incredibly boring, but is about $500 billion worth of boring stuff. Alternative minimum tax, you don't want to know. But it does mean that inevitably the revenue losses will be much larger. The other was that at the last moment, there was some concern about the revenue just before the tax cut was passed in its entirety. And in order to allay those concerns, a resolution was passed requiring that the final form of it be limited in total size. So the 10-year total was limited to $1.35 trillion. It's amazing how we talk these numbers, you know, the U.S. They're all inconceivable, but nonetheless, there they are. So how did they meet that? And the answer is they met it by not by reducing any of the planned tax cuts, but by setting the bill up so that the whole tax cut expired in 2011. So that in the 10th year of the period, taxes revert to their 2000 levels. There were a number of interesting things. One of the things that happens in the year 2010 is that the estate tax, which is gradually phased down, is completely repealed. And then according to the law, on December 30, if your mother dies on December 31st, 2000, there's no tax liability. If she hangs in there till January 1st, 2010. She dies on December 31st, 2010, no tax liability. She dies on January 1st, 2011. Then if it's a large estate, it will be very nearly a 55% tax rate. I believe I was the first to use this. It's the throw mama from the train tax act of 2001. Believe it or not, Bush is out there now saying, this is ridiculous. How did that happen? Of course, it was his own administration that did it to hide the cost of the tax cut. This is pretty crazy stuff. Why would we have done this? How do we explain this? Because, it didn't require deep knowledge of fiscal issues to understand that this was probably not going to work out the way they said it would. And it doesn't require a very extreme view on fiscal responsibility to say, at least let's not lock this in until we have some idea of what's coming. So how did all of this happen? How could the United States have made what now in retrospect looks, unless you really want to squeeze government to an extent that's clearly not going to happen, looks like a colossal mistake. And that's where you get into the issues of sort of deeper political economy. I'd started to do some work on this, and as happens so often in modern academics, I discovered that the expert I really wanted was someone I had never met with an office about 100 yards from mine. I've become a great devotee of some of the work of Keith Poole at Houston and Howard Rosenthal at Princeton, who are quantitative political scientists. And their big thing, or at least probably isn't, they would probably object to that, but the thing that I can use is that they've done studies on mapping political positions of politicians. I can describe it very vaguely, but essentially, if you have a number of, this is a known thing, I guess, if you have a number of bills and a number of people who voted on those bills, and you assume that there's a left-right ranking among the people and that there's a left-right ranking on the bills, you can feed it all into the computer and extract the positions of the bills and of the people. So that you can rank things along a scale. Now, they do something that's substantially more complicated than that, and it also it recognizes that politics isn't one-dimensional. So they have they allow for that possibility. And it turns out that U.S. politics is not one-dimensional. It's two-dimensional. It turns out that you can almost perfectly predict how somebody's going to vote based on one scale, which is very clearly left-right. Essentially, it's about progressive income taxes and social benefits, and the other of which is race relations, which I don't need to talk about, thank God, tonight. Along that left-right scale, because individual politicians have careers that span some length of time, and so you get to, in effect, calibrate different bills, even taking place at different times, you're able to trace out the evolution of politics, the positions of the parties, over the years. And what turns out to be true, not a surprise actually once you think about it, is that U.S. politics since the 1980s has become radically polarized. That there used to be a substantial block of people overlapping. There were definitely Democrats who were more conservative than some Republicans and vice versa. Republicans who were more liberal than some Democrats. The center did not hold. The middle vanished. What actually happened is that the Democratic Party stayed about where it was, and the Republican Party moved way off to the right, opening up this very large gap. So we have a deeply polarized political system. There really is no center if you look at representatives in Congress. And what you have then is the side on the attack, the side that's making progress, essentially was pushing the tax cut as a way of getting the whole agenda of downsizing government, creating starving government as a way of forcing cuts in government programs they don't like. I think that's just the way to say it. There were people, journalists, who somehow imagined that the election of 2000 was a campaign between two centrists. It wasn't. I'm not sure there are any centrists in the U.S. anymore. But it was certainly a campaign in which one side with a very clear agenda passed, but because that agenda couldn't be easily sold lock, stock, and barrel, it was sold on the pretense that the tax cut was affordable, and then that in turn is supposed to create the environment for what follows. What lies behind the polarization of politics? This is a pretty dramatic political event. Why is this happening? And here's where we as an economist, I just have to say, you know, I'm not competent to talk about this, but I'm going to go ahead anyway. And I can at least I can cite Poole and Rosenthal. I should mention this. It's not the poor man's fault, but Keith Poole does happen to be the Kenneth Lay Professor of politics at Houston. It gives you an idea. That is slightly relevant to what's happening in all of this, I think. What they point out quite naturally is that if you look at the polarization of U.S. politics over the long haul, it tracks very closely measures of income inequality. That the likely scenario is that the rapidly rising inequality of income in the United States in the last 25 years has somehow translated into this political polarization. The models, economists have actually tried to model this stuff, and at least initially it turns out to be a slight problem, because what you would expect naively, if you think about a democratic system, is that the an increase in income inequality, which it doesn't actually spread evenly around the middle, it's always skew, so that the when income inequality rises, the mean, the average income, rises relative to the median income. So the voter in the middle is further below the average out there, that there should be if politics caters to the median person in society, that increased income inequality should lead to more redistributive policies. It should lead to increased taxes and greater benefits for people towards the bottom. In fact, that hasn't happened in the United States, and it's actually not true in general. In general, increased inequality seems to be associated with lower rates of taxation and less redistribution. My colleague Roland Benabou at Princeton has a simple explanation for that. Two pieces. One is that you have to think of government spending as actually being a good thing, not simply redistribution. And secondly, you have to think that whatever it may say in your constitution, not all people count equally. That in practice, people with high incomes have more political weight than people with low incomes. In that case, an increase in income inequality actually leads to a growing disregard on the part of the people at the top for public spending that does something good, and a greater concentration on lower taxes. I know that, despite my best efforts, that's coming out sounding rather liberal in the American sense. But I think the story has to be that, in some sense, that the balance of political influence has shifted towards the top as the top has become wealthier, and that the drive to reduce taxes, which has in turn led to this current fiscal morass, is driven by that. A question in all of that, I should say one more thing about the political economy. What that doesn't quite explain, and I don't think I've seen a good explanation, is why we don't have parties catering to the median, maybe not the median voter, but the median something. If you were trying to think who holds the political balance, it's probably somebody with an income of, I don't know what, $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year. The parties don't seem to cater to that. The Democrats are clearly catering to somebody lower down the scale, and the Republicans, though they would, if there are any in the room, you will deny this vehemently, are catering to somebody much further up the scale. So in fact, we get the polarization of politics. But in any case, something has happened. It's very important for people who sort of follow the United States and have a notion of the way we were. If you're thinking about U.S. politics of 1990 or 1985, to realize that this is not that country. That we are a far more divided society than we were then, probably because economically we are far more unequal society than we were then, and it just changes everything. The distinctive feature of the economic proposals that have been passed is, in fact, their strong tilt towards not the top quintile, which is the way some people still sometimes start to look at it, not even towards the top 5%, but towards some subset of the top 1% of the population. The case in point, when fully phased in, about a quarter of the Bush tax cut would of the revenue loss would be accounted for by the repeal of the estate tax. And the estate tax is, there's a $650,000 exemption in U.S. law, which is double for a couple. So essentially, nobody with an estate, this is, sorry, the old law, nobody with an estate under $1.3 million would pay any tax. That was itself enough to reduce it to only 2% of families paid any tax at all. If you actually looked, the last data I have are for 1999, you discover that more than half of the tax was collected from estates of more than $5 million. So that it was, which is about 0.2% of the population. So that another way of saying it is, in 1999, half of the estate tax, which was a real priority, was paid by only 3,300 estates in the whole United States. How do we get? Well, we certainly had policies that were seemed to do their greatest benefit to people at the very, very top end of the scale. Associated with that is the other issue that I mentioned a little bit before, which is the enforcement and the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service. I've been talking to some people who are getting quite hysterical about this issue. And here's the story. The United States, of course, has a tradition that people do pay their income taxes. Tax fraud is, tax evasion, tax avoidance is rampant, but tax evasion has historically been quite rare. Most people don't do it. And they don't do it partly because it's just a sort of social norm, partly because relatively few people do it, and the resources of the Internal Revenue Service were sufficient that if you did do it, you had a pretty good chance of being caught. Two things have happened. The IRS has been starved of resources. Since the early 90s, its workforce is down about 20%, while, of course, the population has grown quite a lot. And then there's something called the Restructuring and Reform Act, RRA 98, which sharply shifts the onus in investigations. In particular, an IRS agent who aggressively pursues what he believes to be tax evasion may well find himself personally sued. So between those two things, audits by the IRS are down by two-thirds from their peak in the mid-1990s. Basically, if you have income that is automatically reported, like wages, then you better pay taxes on it. If you have income that is not automatically reported, business income, capital gains, playing IRS roulette is now your tax advisor won't actually say you should do it, but will hint strongly it's worth it. And that's still not happening that much, but there are some signs it's beginning to happen in increasing amounts. Dennis Kozlowski, you may have seen the CEO of Tyco, was actually caught doing some tax evasion, but who knows how many people have not. That means that we may be seeing a serious erosion of the tax base from lack of enforcement. Again, it's do people here even know who Leona Helmsley was? Hotel queen in some years ago, but famous for her remark, "Only the little people pay taxes." And we may be moving a little bit in that direction. Okay, consequences. What does it all do to the United States? A deficit of 1.5% of GDP is not really world class. This is not something that by itself would appear terrifically ominous. It's true that since we have very low inflation, most of that is actually really, honest to God, a deficit. It's not one of those things that's inflated by large, that is largely matched by erosion of the real value of federal debt. But it's not that big a number. What we do face is the demographic time bomb. I guess everyone, all advanced countries now face that. The United States had a very large cohort of births between the end of World War II and the beginning of the 1960s. The first wave of that starts to hit the retirement systems in 2011. Because the U.S. government is in very large part a retirement system. That is, if you look for what the federal government spends its money on, about 40% of it is accounted for by Social Security and Medicare, which are the actual retirement programs. And then a significant amount of additional stuff is actually age-related. We're looking, I think by European standards, the numbers are not extreme, but we are looking at a situation where right now we have roughly 3 people of working age to retiree, and that will descend to below 2 over the course of the next 40 or so years. So that's significant. If you try and ask about the sheer age-related stuff, I think it would mean that the U.S. spending, U.S. federal spending, would rise by something like 4% of GDP in the end. Now, is that certainly the responsible thing would be to pay off the debt, create some real funding behind Social Security and Medicare in advance of the retirement of the baby boomers. And for about a year there, we actually thought we were looking responsible, but that was an illusion, obviously. Still, suppose that we arrive at the point where it becomes necessary to find an extra 2% of GDP. That's not technically a difficult thing, because the United States has a relatively low tax burden compared with other advanced countries. Total, federal, state, and local is around 30% of GDP, which is low by European standards. Canada, I should note, UK is something shy of 40. Canada is 40. It's certainly, other advanced countries raise 10% more of GDP in taxes than we do, and they survive. So it's not, an advanced country like the United States certainly has the ability, the resources, the taxing capacity to meet the demands of our retirees, even if we are thoroughly irresponsible for the next 10 years, which I think is a given. The question is not really ability, it's will, and that's where it starts to become a little scary. What's happening right now is that not simply that we have some looming budget problems, but that we, because of the political polarization, we seem to be incapable of dealing with them. Now, the federal government has essentially, certainly still has plenty of credit, and is in no difficulty borrowing, in the sense that, I mean, there, people are certainly willing to buy U.S. treasuries. So the federal government could go on like this for quite a while without inflicting any serious pain. We're in deep, I guess Bush's father used to talk about deep yogurt. So we're in deep yogurt already because of self-inflicted issues. And keep desperately checking the news. Luckily, I think as of today, they haven't resolved it, so I can still talk about the impending catastrophe. We have a little thing called the debt limit. There is a limit to the amount of paper, the amount of treasuries out there that the federal government is allowed to issue. We actually hit it about a month ago. But they've been doing fancy financial footwork to hide it, essentially borrowing from the pension funds to avoid it. But according to Treasury Department, this Friday they will have run out of maneuvers. So we need an increase in the debt limit. But to date, although the Senate has passed a resolution increasing the debt limit, the House has been unwilling to do it because that would need admitting that we are having a budget problem. So we actually have the not entirely zero possibility that this weekend the U.S. government will not be able to mail out Social Security checks. Now that's not, I mean, in some sense, fun, this is not a problem, but it's an indication of the amount of political deadlock in the system. The trains, Amtrak, is apparently going to shut down on Wednesday unless it's given a loan guarantee. But because of the environment of fiscal austerity, No one is willing to, has been willing to appropriate the money to keep the system running. So the train, you know, here we are at the very early stages of this budget problem, and we're already having these kinds of catastrophes. We also have a decentralized system in which state and local governments are, you know, are on their own. Nearly all state governments are required by their own laws to run balanced budgets year by year. So they don't have the ability to, in principle, they don't have the ability to ride out bad times by borrowing. In practice, they can do do things too, but those are quite limited. And what we're already seeing now, because of the recession, is savage budget cuts at the state and local level. Sharp cutbacks in services, cutbacks in programs of medical aid to the poor, and so on. The natural thing would be for the federal government to provide some revenue sharing to avert some of this. After all, we're still a very rich country. But of course, in the current environment, that's not a conceivable action. So the result of all of this is that we are, by the numbers, we ought not to be in deep trouble. By the numbers, nothing has happened that we couldn't pretty easily deal with. But the political economy behind the numbers makes sensible actions very difficult to carry out. Of course, the most natural thing of all would be to, not a solution, by the way, not big enough, but at least the natural thing would be to revisit some part of that tax cut. It would seem to be sort of a completely obvious thing to say, well, given the revenue situation, let's at least freeze it where it is. Let's not continue with the phased-in parts that proceed later in the decade. But I think that politically there's almost no chance of that happening. In fact, it's taken some hard work by the opposition to kill the move to put that 20 tax expiration out of business and make the tax cut permanent forever. So we seem to be nowhere near fiscal sanity. I guess the shock for me, and I'll bring it to an end here, has been how quickly things have changed, and not just the fact that the numbers changed quickly, because I think I had known from talking to the tax people that they didn't really understand why receipts were so high towards the end of the 1990s, that there was a large X factor, that they suspected it had a lot to do with the stock market, and they weren't sure if it would last. So I'm not that surprised to see this abrupt fiscal deterioration. What does surprise me is the political deterioration. I thought I knew that we were, you know, basically a pretty sensible country, that in the end we could, you know, work things out, that the crazies, you know, there were crazies, but ultimately good sense would prevail. At the moment, I have to say that all looks like wishful thinking, that the apparent fiscal sensibility that we had towards the late 90s turns out to have been kind of an accident of a political deadlock that worked the right way, in which the Republicans couldn't get their tax cuts, in which the Democrats couldn't get their spending programs, we were in fact much more like Argentina than we thought we were, and getting a little bit more so each day. Thanks.
What a fascinating talk, and I must say, I can't imagine anybody else who could have made numbers sound interesting like Paul did. Quite a tour de
force. I can solve that. Let me talk about alternative minimum tax.
Okay, no, lovely talk. Now, who wants to start the questioning? We've got some mics here. Yes, right in front of you there.
Thank you.
Professor Cargerman, after the Republican sweep of Congress in 1994-95, many Republicans pushed for spending cuts in the name of cutting the deficit and balancing the budget. But people found this attitude to be uncaring and harsh, and so they reelected Bill Clinton. Bush's current budget, according to The Economist, includes a rise of 9% in government spending, including a rise of all non-defense spending of 2%.
Can you just put the question?
Plus tax cuts. As a political commentator, in your opinion, why is it politically beneficial for Republicans to readopt a failed strategy?
Oh. No, I mean, it's... look, I think you have to just... I'm not quite sure. I mean, I don't really pretend to understand politics any better than the next guy. I think the main thing that one has to say right now is that the very few people are sitting, very few people are logging on to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities website and looking at, you know, how the numbers actually play out. I think if you ask the man in the street, I think there have been some polls, most people believe that the deterioration in the budget is because of the war on terror. And, you know, that's off by an order of magnitude, but that's, you know, it's not what... what someone who just, you know, it's not what an ordinary person who's got a life, unlike people like me, would conclude. And in general, there's just a lot of misinformation. So what can you say? The campaign against the estate tax, I think, was a real wake-up call for those of us who thought that basically people understand what's going on. It was sold as something to save, you know, small businesses and family farms, which no one has ever been able to find an example of a family farm that was lost because of estate tax, but nonetheless the legend persists. When people, random groups of people are asked, how many of you think that you'll be paying estate taxes, 30% of them say they will, when the actual number is under 2. So, you know, it's just, and of course, September 11th created a vast dust cloud behind which a lot of things can be hidden.
You discussed the polarization aspect in the coming in the 1990s. One thing you didn't discuss, I mean, we said the Republicans moved to the right, the Democrats were sort of stayed on the left. I think most people would disagree. I mean, I think we saw Clinton over 8 years, we saw a sprint to the right in the Democratic Party. And I think we also see more of that in terms of what I'm quite curious to hear your comments on are with the census changes and the new redistricting coming out, we have roughly 30, 40 seats tops that are competitive. Do we really expect any changes with the midterm elections?
Okay, that's a good question. I mean, there's a running debate. You know, if you are a Naderite, you believe that the Democrats and the Republicans have become indistinguishable, which I think is not at all true. What is true is that the Democrats, I would not say the Democrats have stayed on the left. The Democrats are where Democrats in Congress are roughly where they were, as far as we can tell. 15 years ago. The Clinton administration, I'm not sure you'd say it made a sprint to the right unless you regard free trade as a key left-right issue. And this is one of these places where I cease to be regarded as a reliable liberal because I'm also a free trader. But what is true is that the Clinton administration did not crack down on business. And was a period of rapid increases in inequality that the administration did nothing to stop. That might have been quite different, you know, had Clinton not lost control of Congress in '94. I'm not sure. I think there is a large difference between the parties. I mean, I guess the right way to answer this, to pose it, is to ask, you know, does it matter what happens in November 2002? If the Republicans regain control of both houses, or it remains as it is now with split control, or the Democrats end up in control of both houses, will that make a difference to economic policy? And the answer is yes, it'll make a huge difference. All three are, by the way, real possibilities. So, you know, future history is very uncertain right now. Unless you start from a kind of a vantage point so far removed to the left, I guess that the policies are indistinguishable. A lot is still in the balance.
I want to ask a question. Oh, you got it. Okay. Just a quick one about the that it is visibly possible to have a 10% rise in taxes paid by the average citizen. I mean, I even not understanding politics very well, that just seems like political suicide, and it doesn't seem like that would ever really visibly happen. What do you think are the alternatives as far as stabilizing our Social Security?
The 10% was a number I gave as what's possible. It's not what's needed. Half that would probably do. It's anyone who proposed it now might as well, you know, look for a job driving a taxi or something. So it's something that we're talking about happening in the year 2015. By which time there'll be a lot more retirees, and they will demand their benefits, and they're already a very powerful political force. But you know, there's a real question. I mean, how does it happen? When I say that, you know, when I always like to compare the United States with Canada because it's helpful. Americans don't, you know, sort of believe in Europe. They don't know it quite where it is, and they certainly don't, they're sure that it's all very strange. And Canada is a little less alien, although we tend to forget it's there. And so there's Canada, it's you know, it's right next door, but it's extremely different. Essentially, it's a European country if you look at the policies. And the reason for Canada as a comparison is that it shows that it is possible, it can be done, that you can have essentially a much larger welfare state than the United States does. Now, how it got there, you know, there's a long political history. I don't see, it's very difficult to envisage the path by which the United States does that. And there are many other scenarios that are much less pleasant, including, you know, runaway debt, some kind of savage cuts in benefits for retirees, though that's also impossible. I think if you actually, if you try to, you know, play out the political story, I think you come up with a list of things that can't possibly happen, and together that list excludes are all, you know, it leaves no room for anything that actually can happen. So something's going to have to give, but I don't know what.
Jump now.
One alternative solution might be higher immigration, which of course can alter the dependency ratio quite dramatically. US has a long history of immigration, and I'm surprised you didn't mention that in your reply to the last question.
Okay, yes, it's an important part of the reason why the US aging problem is not as bad. I mean, if you look at the OECD report on aging, the United States barely rates compared with some other countries, and that's partly higher birth rates, but it's largely immigration, and that's certainly something we've got working in our favor. There is an anti-immigration movement in the United States, not nearly as virulent so far, but I think it does raise some questions. I don't know that it would be hard to envision an acceleration of immigration as a political policy. It might be, you know, if you try to think about wild stories, and maybe that's what you need, you know, we could have a guest worker program for the Mexicans or something like that. But I think it's problematic. God knows. I think, you know, let me give you a happy outcome. Instead of immigration, one thing that could happen is that we simply have explosive productivity growth, you know, and that, which we've done fairly well at, but unfortunately it needs more than that to solve these problems. That would, you know, if you give me, there are a couple of deus ex machina solutions. Immigration would be one of them, artificial intelligence would be another, you know.
Well, another one is later retirement. I mean, what's your assessment of the politics and economics of later retirement versus tax increases?
Well, we've actually got, you know, the Social Security system is actually, as I understand it, there's a gradual phase-in. The retirement age is slowly pushing up anyway, so that by, I don't know the date, sometime far enough away to not affect my parents but affect me, it will be up to 67. Geez, the U.S. already has. We've been learning. My wife and I have been here and discovering that people here have a tendency to retire rather early. The U.S. already has a fairly late retirement age, and it will be pushed up. But again, it's... I want to say, I think that the fiscal problems are not unmanageable, even if we completely diddle away this next decade, which, as I say, it seems to be in sight. But the question is, will we have the kind of political system that will do what is technically possible in the next decade?
Yes.
Could you just speculate a little on who in the political system has any incentive to redress the balance?
If I believe if I believe Roland Benabou's model, what he has is that he has this story, which I quite like, in which it's just a given that people with higher income have more political clout, and in which you get a kind of vicious circle in which increase in inequality leads to a less generous welfare state, more regressive policies feeding the inequality. It does eventually come to a stop. It comes to a stop basically when the outraged 95th percentile is sick of the privileges being given to the people in the top 0.2%. And I guess that might be that's your scenario. The rebellion of the second assistant vice presidents, I guess, against the CEOs, and we may be getting there. I mean, maybe that's the point we're heading for. Because if you look, with both the policies and the reality have been tilted very heavily towards people. Put it this way: when I read the stories about Chris Gent, and I couldn't believe that people were making such a fuss out of what, by U.S. standards, is such a tiny sum of money.
$1.5 billion.
Yeah.
Right.
Two short questions related to expenditure.
I've lost the speaker.
Here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you didn't mention the farm bill, and I just wanted to know if you think that's going to be a lot of money in the future, and if you think there's going to be even more anti-free trade stuff like that. And even if, the second short question, even if bombing Afghanistan sounds like peanuts, is the Star Wars program and what could come next peanuts as well?
Okay, I don't know if people know the famous 60s remark by Everett Dirksen, a billion here, a billion there, and soon you're talking about real money. you have to update it now, so it's now 10 billion here, 10 billion there. And none of these things by themselves is that big. I mean, the farm bill is, it's $20 billion a year, which again, in a $10 trillion economy or a $2 trillion federal budget is not that big. Star Wars, we don't know how big that's going to get eventually, but it's something, same order of magnitude. Those are not by themselves crushing blows, but they start to add up, and there's a whole lot of things. There are other things like that in the pipeline. Free trade, yeah, I think comment on U.S. My understanding of the U.S. political scene right now is that it's quite finely balanced between the two parties, and each party basically believes that the other is evil, and they're probably right. And they will do the incentive to buy votes in battleground states is enormous. So that we the steel tariff is really about three electoral votes in West Virginia, which could make, would have made the difference. Had Clinton given in to the steel industry and given them that tariff in 2000, Al Gore would be sitting in the White House. So it's that finely bound, and there are going to be lots more of those. The other thing to say, something important about U.S., is that we do have a rotten borough political system, that the Senate is each state, regardless of population, has two seats, which also gives small population states a disproportionate share in the election of presidents. Half of the U.S. Senate is elected by only 16% of the population. So look for small states to get a lot of privileges, many of which will come at the expense of our trading partners.
Last one.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Professor Krugman.
It's quite rare, perhaps unprecedented, for a New York Times column to be given to an economist. I'm wondering how successful you think the column's been, how successful it's possible to be for an economist to speak to the layperson, cut through the misinformation you mentioned earlier.
Well, I guess the readers have to be the judge of that. Let me just say, I had I don't think the communication is a problem. I have to say, I found myself saying some things that have not been terribly popular. I probably, on balance, sell papers, which is all that the Times cares about, right? That's not true. I have a great admiration for the special institution. But you know, probably there are more people who buy the paper to see what on earth I'm saying this time than refuse to buy the paper because of that that commie. It's a discipline. I mean, I thought I would, in fact, be primarily in the role of trying to explain interesting things to a broader audience. I didn't quite realize I'd be in the trying to explain horrible things to a to a mass audience. But you know, a lot of things do boil down. If you think very hard about what has to be said, what people really need to know, I think it's doable. I'd recommend the discipline to people. Try to express your argument about some important concept in 730 words. It's quite an interesting experience.
Well, I think that's a good note on which to end. I must say, what you've just said and what you've been saying for the last hour is actually highly relevant to the debate about spin, which is going on in this country. And one does wonder whether the role of academics, intellectuals, and others could not be better performed than it is in drawing attention to the nonsense which is written both by and spoken by politicians and also written by many journalists. I have a little plot to form some sort of web-based commentary which would be called the mistake of the week, and you would have a group of people who would be looking out for the mistake of the week, either by a politician or by another journalist, and exposing it, because there is very little exposure that goes on of things which the authors themselves know to be false. And I think you're performing a tremendous function, and I think it's an amazing thing that one of the world's greatest economists should be actually attacking deception, which is economic deception, that is practiced on us. So, Paul, all power to you, and thank you very much for talking to us.